We get things rolling here this afternoon by welcoming back to the program our friend Colin Fleming, who is maybe not at 100%. Was it because you went to watch BC kick the bejesus out of UMass?
I don't know, man. I'm faltering. I'll try to power through here, but yeah, that was a little anticlimactic. But it was your game too, right?
Yeah, it was, but we don't mind that when we're on the good side of things.
Right, yeah. Some of these early season games are just kind of like glorified practices, it feels a little bit like.
Well, we want to talk about a couple of things that you've published recently until you can't do it anymore, and then you just say, no, I'm done. That's it. Let's start with this, a great piece in the American Interest about one of my all-time favorite movies, and I think anybody would say one of the classic Westerns of all time, The Oxbow Incident, 75 years old.
Classic Western, but not, wouldn't you agree, what we think of normally as an odor, as a Western, really. It's not within that same kind of framework of a cowboy who's avenging something, and there will be tumbleweeds, and we know what's going to happen, and it's very different. It's more like this play, like this 12 Angry Men type of deal, transferred to the Old West.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the reasons I think it holds up so well after all these years. A great movie. You point out that, yeah, Henry Fonda, who didn't always have a lot of good things to say about some of his work, often spoke of this as one of his favorite movies that he ever made.
Well, he definitely knew tripe, Henry Fonda, and I feel like he was one of those actors who was known for roles that were supposed to be these great films that really aren't these great films, like Grapes of Wrath or whatever, but he always seemed to do better in smaller kind of vehicles for him. Films that weren't really expected to be big box office, like this particular film, this William Wellman film that we're talking about, the studio didn't know what to do with it. They put it on the shelf. They're like, people are not going to go for this. This is too glum. It's too grim. What happens basically is these two drifters and Fonda is one of them, and Harry Morgan of MASH fame is the other. They come into this just depressing town, and they go to this even more depressing saloon, and it's just like, even by Western standards where the saloons are grim, it's like, man, this is bringing me down watching this in the movie theater. Like, I feel like I want to drink after watching this, and people's tempers are on edge, and Fonda gets into a fight about his girl, who's not really his girl, a saloon woman, and it turns out that there's this report of a cattleman has been murdered, and a posse is going to be rounded up, and they are going to leave this one set, basically it's a three-set film, and they're going to head out, and they're going to string them up.
You point out in your piece, Colin, that while Bill Wellman, who had won an Academy Award, or the first Academy Award-winning film was Wings, that he directed in 1927, that had some incredible aerial shots here. But he was so far ahead of his time in the way his films, including this one, approached the concept of masculinity.
Sure, and when he first got to Hollywood, Wellman, he was there because someone said, huh, you're a really good-looking guy. You can make some money in Hollywood. And he went, and he was an actor, and he thought, you know what, this is very effeminate. Which now we would think like, huh, that's, I mean, you're supposed to be like non-binary or whatever type of bollocks people talk about. But he ends up doing very sensitive films that have as much of what we might think of as a so-called feminine side as a masculine side. It's really just basically a very human side that invites all of us within its fold. And he realizes this in stunning ways to me. Like, if you watch the main sort of meat play out of the Oxbow Incident, it's around this campfire where the marauding posse comes upon the alleged banditos. And it's almost like German expressionism. Like, if you've seen Nosferatu, or you've seen The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, everything, the lighting, everything is very angular. It's very contrasty between black and white. And there's even a cyclorama in this set. And cyclorama is basically, you'd see one in something like Bride of Frankenstein from James Whale in 1935. Cyclorama is a curtain that's just like when you go to a play, right? Like your kid's middle school play, and there's like the curtain with the stars. That's the cyclorama. That's kind of like the level of artifice that he's okay with in this film, that kind of expressionism. Because you're not really concerned with the trappings of the stage and stagecraft. You're interested in what's playing out in this drama, and it gives a sort of like queasy, absurdistly hyper-real feeling to the proceedings, and it plays out as you would imagine it probably does play out. Things do not work out for these men, and these men are not whom they were supposed to have been, and it leads up to one of the best lines in all of cinema, even though no one knows it, when they're riding back to town, and they find out the truth, and someone says basically, well, who was responsible for this? And one of the people who was all about justice with the posse who's trying to check everyone from doing what they did says all but seven, because basically they had gone on different sides of a line at one point, and Henry Fonda's character and Harry Morgan's character were two of the seven who said, no, let's slow this down, let's wait. And it's a lot like our digital social media mob of right now. I saw it at the theater, and you could feel how uncomfortable it made people who probably, like earlier that day, were having at people online.
Some remarkable performances in this, and I think one of the really underappreciated talents from this time period, Dana Andrews, is so good in this movie.
He is, and he basically has to do the yeoman's work of the three alleged villains, right, who aren't villains. And Anthony Mann is one of them, and there's like a crazy old man who's basically role is to be there, John Ford's brother, actually, and be kind of a crazy old man. So that's like the bulk of his acting performance. So, right, Andrews has this sort of responsibility of providing backstory and exposition. And you know how clunky exposition can be? Like when you're watching something and someone walks into a room and they just recapitulate like everything that's happened to him prior to that. Like, so you say you started working at this job 7 years ago. Yes, I did. And they just go through it like that. But he also not only has to carry backstory, he has to carry future story, because part of this film is going to play out after the final scene back in the saloon with a letter that Dana Andrews' character has written, which Henry Fonda and Harry Morgan are going to have to take to his now widow. So there's a lot on his plate in terms of what he has to get done in this sort of like third of a film.
Well, if you haven't watched it, check out The Oxbow Incident. It's worth your time. Not just one of the great Westerns, one of the great movies of all time. And we're talking with Colin Fleming, of course. And let's transition from that into a recent column. You did an op-ed piece in the New York Daily News that also relates to a rush to judgment.
Right. It's sort of basically hunting white male season now. And I have really no problem saying what I think a lot of balanced, sane people know, and that is that people on all sides of the ledger, all sides of the line, male, female, dogs, cats, right, chipmunks, squirrels, everybody, whatever, whomever it may be, lie. And I have a major problem with this notion that simply because someone comes forward and says, anyone, it can be the Hamburglar, and says, this happened to me, that we automatically have to believe them. Because I think that makes no more sense than automatically disbelieving somebody. Because if we think about our own lives, think about the people that you love in it, and it's not like a huge number, it's not 100 people that you truly love. It's a handful of people and who love you. And some of them have lied to you, right? Your spouse at some point in your life is going to lie to you. Your kid is going to lie to you, and you are going to lie to you. You might probably lie to you more than anyone else you've ever known in life will lie to you, because that's what we do. It's something that helps shield us from what we think can hurt us, and that's sometimes the truth. So it's also this notion, too, of you see it in the NFL. One team does something and it works, and everyone starts doing it. The copycat league. We are copycat humans, and there is money to be made in pivoting, as I think of it. When you see other people set a certain precedent and come forward and say this, and so my piece, the jumping off point, was a woman, a young woman, like sophomore in college, I think, and she was with two members of the Sacred Heart football team simultaneously. And after the fact, she said that she was raped. And it turns out in court, just the other week that she made this up. She had a prospective love interest, and she did not want him to think negative things about her, and she got sentenced to a year in jail. And we're seeing things like that all the time now, where people for millennia have had all kinds of motivation to do what they do. Sometimes it's financial, sometimes it's for attention, sometimes it's to fill the need of the void within. But one of the truisms of this life, there was a Russian futurist poet, and he wrote, a Soviet futurist poet, actually, and he wrote, everybody lies, everybody dies. And yeah, they do. So you are openly committing to being a moron if you say, you know what, you have stepped to the front of the line and you've said this thing, and I automatically believe you. And you are a bad person if you say, you know what, if you don't automatically believe that stranger, you're a toxic individual. You are the evil patriarchy. No, I'm just not an idiot. I was not born the proverbial day before yesterday. It's just reality, and it will always be reality and has been since we slithered out of the ocean.
Well, hey, it's important to believe people enough to follow up and do a little investigation, but to blindly believe everyone. I always think back in the Reagan years. I think it was Reagan's Secretary of Labor, a guy named Ray Donovan, who was charged with fraud. And when he was found not guilty, he came out of the courthouse and said to the press, where do I go to get my reputation back?
Well, it's almost like, think of children. That's what I wrote about kids in the piece. Like, when you're in first grade, right, and you're like wide-eyed, and you're like, okay, I'm doing this. I'm growing up. I'm listening to what teacher has to say. And teacher says to you, always ask questions, which kids don't need any real encouragement with, right? Because they're always asking questions. We lose that capacity to question as we go along. And think about what a question really is. A question is one of the most powerful things in this world, because a question is a statement. If I say to you, Rich Kimball, did you enjoy a Dunkin' Donuts coffee today? What I'm also saying to you is, you know what? Maybe you enjoyed a Dunkin' Donuts coffee today. That's a statement. A question is always a statement, always. And the more questions you ask, the more statements you are, in fact, making simultaneously. And yet, then we are told as adults, stir cease with your questioning. Just jettison that from your rhetorical arsenal and blindly follow, or you're bad. And you know what? These same people who say that are always banging on and on and on about a fascist state. A society that doesn't ask questions is, by definition, a fascist state. That's what an autocracy is. That's how it works. You're not even allowed to ask the question. And so you listen. And you know what? If it's not your life and it's something that's happening out there and it's maybe not your business and it doesn't impact your day one way or the other, if it happened or if it didn't happen, but if you have a vested interest in it, or you're trying to help someone out, or you want to work on the cause of something or on someone's behalf, find out what you're dealing with. People are married for 35 years and they find out that this person they loved lied to them. Like, it's just how it goes. It doesn't make that person who lied a bad person, because good people lie too. Everybody lies at some point or other. And it's not once or twice in a lifetime. So I think it's just not having scales over your eyes.
Check out all of Colin's work at his website, ColinFlemingLit.com. Colin, as always, a pleasure. Hope you're feeling better soon, my friend. We'll check in next week.
All right. Thanks a lot.